Good morning, and welcome to the Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022 meeting of the House Education Finance Committee. I'm Representative Jim Davney. Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached in the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Mr. Lee, will you please take a call of the roll?
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Roll call will commence now. Chair Dabney?
Present.
Representative Sandstead?
Present.
Representative Kreshaw?
Kreshaw, present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Daniels?
Daniels, present.
Representative Daymuth? Representative Daymuth? Representative Drefkowski?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Erickson, present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Jordan, present.
Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, present.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller, present.
Representative Richardson?
Richardson, present.
Representative Thompson?
Thompson, present.
Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott, present.
Representative Shung?
Present. Zhang, present.
Representative Joaquin?
Joaquin, present.
We have 16 members present. There's quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee.
Representative present.
Pardon? Representative Daymuth, thank you. Representative Erickson, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from our Tuesday, March 1st meeting? And if so, would you move their approval?
Representative Erickson moves approval of the minutes for February 20th.
February 29th, March 1st.
March 1st, I'm sorry, yes. I'll do that again, Representative Erickson. Moves approval of the minutes from March 1.
All right, thank you very much, Representative. Any discussion to the Erickson motion? Hearing none, this is a voice vote. If members would please unmute. All those in favor of the Erickson motion approving the March 1 minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, we're going to start today hearing House File 1710 from Representative Wolgamott with a goal of concluding that bill by 11 a.m. Then we'll receive a briefing by MMB and the Department of Education on the February budget and economic forecast. And then we'll have two more bills, one from Representative Feist and one from Representative Wolgamott after the conclusion of the briefing. But let's begin today. Representative Wolgamott, welcome. If you would like to make a motion to move House File 1710 to be before the committee and lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill, please do.
So moved, Mr. Chair. That is my motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wolgamott, please introduce your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to come before you to present House File 1710, which is a bill to increase our funding to the 12 regional public library systems by $2 million each year. The 12 systems currently receive $13.57 million per year, and that number has remained flat for the last 15 years. This bill also amends the distribution formula for the 12 regional library systems, a change that will stabilize funding to each region by reducing the vol equalization factor and increasing the basic aid portion of the formula. And I just want to be clear that all 12 of our regional libraries support this adjustment. As you know, members, libraries provide so many opportunities to so many people throughout every corner of our state, whether it's to check out a new book, attend a cultural event, use the internet to apply for a job, participate in community programming. Everyone in our library benefits when we invest in our community. but unfortunately our regional libraries haven't received an increase in funding from the legislature since 2007. So that's why we're here today to get this much needed funding. And that's it for me for now, Mr. Chair. And I do have a testifier for my community who is available to shed more light on this with your permission, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wolgemon. I have three testifiers listed. The first is Karen Punzak, Executive Director of the Great River Regional Library System. Ms. Punzak, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Karen Punzak. I'm the director of Great River Regional Library, which is one of Minnesota's 12 regional public library systems. We operate 32 libraries in central Minnesota, in cities as large as St. Cloud and as small as Great Eagle. Thank you, Chair Dabney and Education Finance Committee members, for the time to talk about the impact of regional library basic system support. Thanks also to Representative Wolgemon for authoring House File 1710 and your enthusiastic support of public libraries. House File 1710 asks for a $2 million increase in state library aid and a change to the distribution formula. This change would stabilize the main source of state public library funding. This formula is more volatile than other educational formulas. Its factors include a base amount, land area, population, and equalization, which includes adjusted net tax capacity. It is not unusual for a library's distribution amount to vary by 30% or more year over year, and some systems have seen steady declines in funding for more than 5 years. The 12 library regions representing all 87 counties and their governing boards agree that this formula is flawed. We ask for an increase in funding to adjust the formula without taking dollars away from any region. Both the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties also support this change. Because of the formula has fluctuated so much over the past decade, some systems struggle with reduced funding. Plum Creek Library System, which is headquartered in Worthington, recently had to make a choice between hiring a permanent director and replacing their book delivery van with over 500,000 miles on it. Plum Creek has seen a reduction in state aid almost every year since 2013, even with no change to the overall state allocation. And this is just one example of how the formula's instability negatively impacts the services Minnesotans receive. Public libraries provide vital access to technology and broadband. For example, our library has distributed hotspots to Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota for their work with students and families. In our Waite Park Library last month, a woman came in a bit panicked because she was scheduled for a job interview the next day via Zoom and didn't have internet access. Our library staff were able to lend her a hotspot and show her how to use the technology for her interview. Stories like this happen in all 347 communities with a public library across the state. Libraries are a place where all people are invited and welcome. We're inclusive and embrace diversity. We're dedicated to finding ways to provide every opportunity to the students and families in our communities. Thank you for the time to present this bill after bringing it to conference committee 2 years ago and last year. We hope this is the year to get this done. Please support this formula change to ensure a stable source of state library funding for all Minnesotans.
Thank you, Ms. Punzak. Next on the list is Dr. Zuria Andrum from the Great River Regional Library Board of Trustees. Dr. Andrum, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Finance Committee members. My name is Dr. Zuria Andrum. I am a psychiatrist and a member of the Great River Regional Library Board of Trustees. Thank you, Representative Wolgemon, for authoring House File 1710 in support of public libraries. I'm a first-generation immigrant from Pakistan, a psychiatrist by profession and mother to two teenage kids. I have served on the Great River Regional Library Board since 2016 and have worked with the board on various issues, including diversity and equity. The library completed a community survey related to this last year, and recommendations from that were added to our next strategic plan for the library. Libraries, as we all know, serve as a gateway to knowledge and culture all over the world. Some people argue that in the 21st century, the need for libraries is diminished as there is digital content available for most consumers. This, however, does not take into account numerous issues that face a community, including language barriers, financial constraints, lack of knowledge in accessing resources and utilizing them, just to name a few. A library provides all of these essential services to its community members. Moreover, marginalized communities use libraries for essential services that they cannot find anywhere else. In the current age, libraries are not just places you visit to get a book. They provide essential resources to expanding vocabulary and knowledge, finding information, and improving computer and technical skills. The impact during the pandemic by the services for the libraries was significantly felt by all the members of the community, and Great River Regional Library stepped up to provide a lot of additional services to help with these issues. The efforts by Great Regional Library are commendable with the financial constraints that they face. More can certainly be done, but that requires a commitment from the state to help them continue this effort. Libraries also serve a critical role in the community. They have always been safe and welcome places for all to meet to pursue their interests. This is even more critical now as we face a generation that has lost the ability to hold a conversation face to face with other people in this digital age. This has led to a host of mental health problems like depression and anxiety that, as a psychiatrist, I see every day. As we face the crucial issue of equity, the library plays a very crucial role in this effort. It serves as a democratic equalizer, providing equal opportunities to people from all color, all races, all religions, and sexual identity. And it can serve as a welcoming community center, paving the way for better understanding and acceptance between different demographic groups. In conclusion, I strongly support House File 1710. This investment in public libraries will repay us with generations of reward and uplift all of our communities. I believe that with the passage of this bill, we will show our communities our commitment to continue to provide services, not only to those who can afford them, but to anybody seeking to overcome barriers in life that limit their ability to succeed. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Antrim. Next on the list is Liz Lynch, Executive Director. And Ms. Lynch, I'm sorry, I've never been confident in my pronunciation of Lake Agassiz?
Agassiz.
Yeah. Oh, well, I can probably remember that.
Yeah.
Director of the Lake Agassiz Regional Library. Ms. Lynch, welcome to the committee. Thank you for educating me. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Chair Dabney and committee members, my name is Liz Lynch, and I'm the Executive Director of the Lake Agassiz Regional Library System, which is headquartered out of Moorhead and provides public library services in 7 counties in Northwest Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of the 12 regional public library systems. And of course, thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for your support of HF 1710. We are here today to talk to you about a flawed and volatile formula and statute used to allocate funds to regional public library systems. With an additional $2 million in funds, this formula could be stabilized, resulting in a more fair and equitable funding stream to all 12 regional systems. In addition, it would allow the governing boards to create budgets based on actual numbers versus anticipated numbers. Why is this change in statute so important? It's because public libraries play a big role in providing stability and support to community members across this state. In many of our communities, the public library is the place where you go, regardless of your age, economic status, or education level, to connect with others, connect with resources for fulfillment and entertainment, and most importantly, access the resources and tools you need to succeed. We start connecting with our community members at their earliest age with story times and 1,000 books before kindergarten, early literacy programs for youth ages 5 and under, which help improve vocabulary, comprehension, and introduces new concepts, teaching youth about the world and the people around them. We extend these same types of literacy services to K through 12 and beyond. Public libraries exist to provide help, assistance and tools to students of all ages by providing reading materials, homework tools, computer equipment, internet access, Wi-Fi hotspots, and more. Last year, I was contacted by a woman who wanted to thank us for helping her husband obtain the books and the internet access he needed to study for a boiler exam. He passed the test, resulting in a better paying job and benefits for his family. This exemplifies the kind of services libraries across Minnesota provide every day. As librarians, we are known in our communities as problem solvers. However, we have one problem that we can't solve on our own, and we need your help. The governing boards of all regional public library systems agree that the formula for funding regional public library systems in statute is flawed. Please support public libraries this legislative session by providing a $2 million increase in funding and modifying the formula for allocating the funds as indicated in HF 1710. This increase in funding, plus a formula change, will allow us to continue to support and connect Minnesotans of all ages in our rural communities and in our urban neighborhoods with the resources, tools, and support they need to succeed. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Ms. Lynch, thank you very much. Members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. We received a request from Bashua Vang, branch manager of the Rice Street Library in St. Paul, to testify. Ms. Vang, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Dabney and committee members. My name is Bashua Vang, and I am the branch manager at the St. Paul Public Library Rice Street branch. We are located in the North End neighborhood of St. Paul. I want to share with you all this morning a snapshot of what a day at Rice Street may look like. You may come in and see that we're hosting Career Lab, which is appointments or drop-in opportunities for one-on-one help on the computer related to job search. Lydia, my colleague, has helped numerous patrons work on resumes, apply for jobs, practice interviewing skills, and so many have come back to tell her they've been hired. We host CreateTech, which is a hanging out, messing around, and geeking out space for our teens ages 12 to 18. We do this 4 evenings a week. On Fridays, it's CreateTech After Dark. When we're closed to the public, we're open just for teens to come in and connect with staff to build those foundational relationships. They may be using our sewing machines or getting on the VR or playing video games. We also host Fun Lab, which is STEAM programming for our elementary school age students. We have homework centers, drop-in homework help for students of all ages, elementary to college age. You may see Reading Together Pairs, which is a one-on-one reading and literacy skill building program with a volunteer mentor and a student in the grades 1st to 5th grade. We also do family story time and many early literacy programming. We are and have been busy at Rice Street. I think you may agree that libraries are essential in providing service, safety, and community connection to residents with the most limited resources, whether they're middle school kids needing a place to hang out before they go home, or our older adult population who are often folks of color or folks with limited English proficiency, working on building their digital literacy and capacity, or those who are unhoused or managing as best they can mental health issues. The library is the one place the most vulnerable in our community can come to get help, explore their curiosity, and simply be. We need basic system support for our libraries to continue to do this important work for those who need it most and ask for very little.
Thank you, Ms. Vang. Member questions? Representative Kreisha, I see you have your hand up.
I think Representative Erickson was up before me, Mr. Chair. Is she still have her hand up?
Representative Kreisha, she does. My apologies. Representative Erickson, I didn't see it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a technical question. Are we hearing 1710 as it was amended last year, or are we hearing a different version? Because I'm confused about the status, because it was amended last year, and then I noticed that it was introduced again. So would you clarify that for us, please?
Certainly. Thank you for asking, Representative Erickson. We're looking at 1710 as amended last year, but we're looking at it as looking forward to fiscal year 23 and going forward. Obviously, if this is included in any future omnibus bill, as is the motion, the staff will make whatever adjustments are necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could Mr. Strom just give us a high-level overview of this contrast between now and what is anticipated if this becomes a law?
Mr. Strom, can you help us out, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I'd be glad to. The formula has several parts to it, as the librarian officials have testified to. Those parts originally were part of a design to pull all of the school district or all of the county systems essentially into the regional program. So there were measures of tax base and population as well as an amount per system for each of the 12 systems. And as was explained over time, and we have a spreadsheet we can share, but I think the librarians will be providing us with an updated one a little later this morning with the new 2020 census. But what's happened, particularly with the tax base and the population measures as these change, is that the system has become more weighted towards those with larger populations. And so the goal is to put more of the funding out on just simply a per system basis for each of the 12 systems. And that will help keep the funding more constant from year to year. I'll share with the committee administrator the 2019 printout, which won't change a whole lot, but as I said, I think the library systems will be giving us an update with the new census information, which has probably changed the population more than in some other years. But the original reason for having such a complicated formula, I think, had its roots in the way in which the regional systems were formed and in trying to get all of the members, all of the county and city libraries to participate in the regional system.
Representative Erickson, does that help?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one question for Mr. Strom. How does this affect the county contributions? Because I know that my counties do contribute to the libraries. I know it's been diminished in amount, but does this affect that at all?
Mr. Chair, members, no. The county contribution, as you may remember, used to be in statute as with a grand person amount essentially in it and a maintenance of effort requirement. And the tax committee undid that about, 8-10 years ago. And so the kind of basic maintenance of effort that used to exist that grew each year isn't really there any longer. But the state aid distributions to the systems don't factor in essentially a subtraction for the county contribution. So the counties are still running their systems, still governed by the contributions that they make. And this is really on top of that all to the 12 regional library systems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rev. Bogema. Thank you for this particular bill. I always said if it makes sense for my community, it makes sense for me. And so my question was for Fasua Vang, branch manager over at the Rice Street Library, because I think for sake of time, she would never be able to share all of the stuff that they do over at the Rice Street Library, because there's a whole lot more. So she's kind of being modest about the work over at Rice Street. But how are you able to sustain all the work? And I always watch you guys, like, get the kids in there and give them everything you have. Like, you even talk about the hot dog barbecues and stuff that you got, but how are you able to sustain without funding? And I heard Rep. Wogelman say that you guys haven't had funding an increase in the past 5 years, and so how are you able to sustain the work at the level of that you guys do over at Rice Street?
Ms. Vang, can you be a little less modest for a minute and talk a little bit more about your work at the Rice Street Library, please?
Thanks for the question. Yes, it's challenging. We work with a lot of community partners. So with our Career Tech program, we do partner with our neighbors across the street at the Rice Rec Center that help staff some of our evenings along with our library staff. We have strong volunteers who come and help us in the homework center or do our reading together program. And so on volunteers and in partnership with community members, we've been able to sustain a lot of this, but it's a lot of passion and hard work from the staff to in order to make this happen. And I wouldn't be wrong, I think, to say that across the board in Minnesota that many libraries are struggling in this capacity. I know that branches within my system aren't able to do as much due to the lack of funding or staffing. And for some reason right now, it's clicking at Rice Street, and we wanted to make sure it continues to click in the right way and across the state.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you so much, Chair. That was my only question, because I always watch the kids. They always flock into that building, and then they're like, come on in, come on in, come on. They're always welcoming the kids, but they give them a lot. So I just wanted to ask, like, because I had no idea. I'm learning also, by the way, Chair. And also, like, right now I'm having a problem with my kid with, like, homework help and things like that. And I can remember when we had to do book reports and we had to go into the encyclopedia and the almanac. We had to do the index cards, and now we could just push a button and everything. And so thank you so much, Chair, for allowing me to ask that question. And thank you so much, Pessoa, for answering my question.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Krisha, it looks like you're last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions for the bill author. So to the bill author, is this bill in response to primarily fixing the allocation formula or in response to deficit spending that occurred over the last 2 years?
Representative Wolgamott?
The bill amends the distribution formula for the 12 regional libraries, and then it increases the funding to the 12 regional libraries by $2 million each year. As I mentioned, the 12 systems currently receive $13.57 million. That's a number that's been flat for the past 15 years.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, so you answered the first half. How about addressing the spending? Was there deficit spending, more spending over the last 2 years? Can you shed some light on that?
Representative Wolgamott.
Deficit spending by the regional libraries, you mean, Representative Krisha?
Representative Krisha, can you clarify, please?
I just would like a little more clarification on which entity Representative Krisha is wondering if there's been deficit spending.
Representative Krisha, can you help us out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. Yeah, can you shed some light on, has the spending gone up over the last 2 years? You're asking for an increase, so you've already let me know that part of it is a funding allocation fix. That makes sense. I just want to know, has the regional system and the entities that are going to receive this money, has their spending gone up, and are they currently in deficit spending?
Representative Wolgamott?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be better to defer to some of the testifiers with the regional library systems to shed further light on how they've been dealing with their budgets.
Ms. Punsack, can you help us out here?
Sure. I think it depends on the region. There's 12 different regions, and each of those regions set their budgets differently. I would say in most cases, if the budget for the library system has gone up or stayed flat, it's because the local funding has filled that gap from the state. So either the cities or the counties that govern that board are actually filling the gap, because the state funding has been declining in some regions. Does that help?
Representative Krisha?
Thank you, and to the testifiers and to the bill author. So we don't have a clear answer as to whether or not the spending has actually created a deficit. I'm just looking to see how big of a gap or what the need really is.
Ms. Punsack, can you help
we
speak to the need?
Yeah, sorry. I will try to be quick, but it's hard to with 12 different regions in the mix. Mm-hmm. We could certainly get you a better report of that, if that would be helpful.
Ms. Lynch, different library system. Do you have any insights to share on this question?
Sure, I wouldn't. The increase is not does not have anything to do with the past 2 years. However, I can speak for Lake Agassiz Regional Library and say that we currently are deficit spending because of the volatile formula. Our cities and counties are paying the majority of our operating budget because we receive so little from the state at this point because of the volatile formula. We are deficit spending because in 2008, we lost almost $100,000 and continued to lose funding for the next 5 years because of the volatile formula. So we are a system in rural Minnesota who is deficit spending. Our counties and cities have stepped up to help out with the funding. Yeah, it's a volatile formula, and some of us are deficit spending, and it is because of this formula used to allocate funds to the regional library systems.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Representative Krisha?
Yep, so thank you very much for that. So what I'm hearing, and I appreciate this, I'm trying to find a solution as well, because my kids have certainly spent much of my dollars on fines and support the library system. But it sounds to me, and maybe Mr. Strom, if you can give me clarification, but we could make the policy change with no fiscal ramifications just to change the funding allocation. And then as I'm hearing that local units are stepping up, which, by the way, isn't a bad thing, especially with counties being very flush with ARPA dollars, but we could get you the immediate fix of fixing the funding allocation and not tying it to a dollar amount that may hold this back. Mr. Strom, would that be correct? We could do a policy fix and move that very quickly without it actually being tied to a fiscal note?
Mr. Strom, can you help us out here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Krisha, the librarians may want to speak to this, but essentially the funding change will change the allocations, and without additional funds put in, those that would lose under the reallocated money may be less likely to support the change. So I think it's a bit of a balance question. If you change the statutory direction of how the money goes to each of the 12 systems without changing the top line number, then there's going to be additional winners and losers, as it were. And I don't know, the librarians have said that at this level of funding, everybody's in all 12 systems are in agreement with the changes to the formula. I'm not sure what lower or higher level would be necessary to still accomplish that change, but I think the statutory issue is that if there were no additional funds put in, some number of the systems may not be willing to support the change any longer. And perhaps the systems want to speak to their process and how they arrived at this number. But really the change in the underlying formula does change the distribution, as well as the characteristics which change each year, like population, change the distribution. But it's probably best for the librarians to speak to how the regional system came to this number.
Ms. Punzak, I think that's you.
Yes. Well, we've recalculated this, I think, every session. And $2 million is the amount we'd need to hold harmless in the current allocation. So anything lower than $2 million would really get at least a couple of the systems less funding than they did in the prior year. There hasn't been an increase in the appropriation since 2007. So if there are people or systems that are receiving more money right now, it's because another system has declined over time. And Great River is actually one of the systems that would lose funding in anything that is a budget neutral policy change at this point, unfortunately.
Representative, thank you, Ms. Punzak. Representative Krisha?
Thank you. So just my closing comments. So thank you very much. It's been very helpful. To the bill author, what I would recommend is to actually break this down and find out who the winners and losers would be, because it sounds like if we did a reallocation, there are entities that would lose money. We'd have to fill in those gaps. And there are other entities that would come out doing very well. And we should not create that situation without knowing exactly what the ramifications are. So this is the most equitable. But thank you for the clarification. Thank you for the conversation, Mr. Strom. And to the bill author, I hope we can get more details to move this forward.
Thank you, Representative Krisha. Representative Wolgamon, any brief closing comments?
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank members of the committee for hearing House File 1710. Again, are these libraries have not received an increase in funding since 2007, and we're asking for $2 million to go to 12 regional libraries. They're going to support, you know, learning, digital literacy, access to the internet, all throughout our state. This is such a good investment, such a good bang for our buck. I want to thank the librarians and all you and all your team for all you do to support Minnesotans throughout our state, and want to urge members' support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. With that, Representative Wolgamott renews his motion to lay over House File 1710 for possible inclusion or for further consideration at a later date. Members, next we'll be hearing a joint presentation from Minnesota Management and Budget and the Minnesota Department of Education about the February forecast that was released on Monday as it relates to the accounts within the K-12 or E-12 jurisdiction. First, we'll hear from Mr. Schoenebrich. Mr. Schoenebrich, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jeff Schoenebrich, and I am an executive budget officer for E-12 education at MMB. Today, I'm joined by Terry Yetter, director of school finance. Director of School Finance at MDE. All right, next slide, please. Looking at the FY22-23 biennium, this forecast increases the projected surplus by $1.5 billion from what we were projecting in November. In November, we were projecting a $7.7 billion surplus, and we are now forecasting a positive general fund balance of $9.3 billion. Higher income, consumer spending, and corporate profits lead to this improved revenue forecast. And while many of the changes are one-time in nature, we continue to project a structural balance in the next biennium. As always, our budget and economic forecast provides a snapshot view of our state's financial health and is never without some degree of risk. As we've noted in the forecast document, which is available on MMB's website, there are several significant risks to the economy, including inflationary pressures and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Next slide. So here are the numbers. These are statewide numbers. We will drill down into the education numbers towards the end. The first column here is the November forecast. The middle column is the new February forecast, and the furthest right column shows the change. Revenues during this year and next are now anticipated to total $57 billion, or $1.252 billion more than November. Similar to the last forecast, the primary story continues to be economic recovery and growth in some key activities. Revenues are up for all major tax types. As we look at the spending side of the forecast, we see lower spending, adding a net of about $270 million to the bottom line. This is driven in large part by decreased spending in education and health and human services. There are no changes in this forecast to Minnesota's rainy day fund. The way the law is set up, reserve triggers happen only in the November forecast. The small change that you see in the last line is the stadium reserve, where a $15 million increase in projected charitable gaming revenues will be set aside for bonds that helped build the stadium. Now to dive a little bit deeper into the spending side of the forecast. This slide outlines changes in general fund spending in the current biennium and provides detail behind that $270 million figure I cited on the last slide. Overall, spending changes are relatively small, about 0.5% lower this biennium compared to the November forecast. E-12 education spending, which as you all know is the largest portion of the general fund budget, is $158 million or 0.8% lower than November projections. We know that's of particular interest to this committee, and Terry will go into those details in later slides, but I'll provide a brief overview of other budget areas. Health and Human Services spending is forecast to be $108 million, or 0.7% below previous estimates. The largest driver of this reduction is additional federal Medicaid funding as a result of the extension of the federal public health emergency. The forecast also reflects $40 million in savings due to lower use of the state's child care assistance program as a result of the pandemic. And then spending for property tax aids and credits was $15 million, 0.4% lower than previous estimates. And projected debt service costs are relatively unchanged from November, and all other areas of the state budget combined have $12 million in higher spending compared to November estimates. Next is a look at the long-term budget outlook. So this shows revenue growth that is expected to exceed projected spending growth into FY24 and 25. So there is structural balance in both the current biennium and in the tails. Note that this comparison generally does not add the impact of inflation into our spending projections, which is estimated at $1.09 billion for the next biennium. This is a current law forecast, which is based on enacted appropriations. So there is, for the most part, no estimate of the bite that inflation will take out of currently funded services. One exception to that general rule is the forecast for special education built in because the statutory funding structure is based partially on actual prior year costs. So the way that we project forward does pick up cost growth. But most elements of the forecast, for example, the general education basic formula, do not assume increases from current law. Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schnoberg. Joining him today is Terry Yetter, School Finance Director for the Minnesota Department of Education. Ms. Yetter, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Terry Yetter. I'm the School Finance Director at the Department of Education. So if you turn to the next slide, please. This slide shows the change in education expenditures from the November forecast. The E-12 education represents about 41% of the state's general fund spending. Overall spending on E-12 education is projected to be down about $158 million or 0.8% in the 22-23 biennium, and then down $52 million or 0.2% in the 24-25 biennium, and that's compared to the November forecast estimates. General education aid accounts for the largest portion of this change and is declining $76 million in the first biennium and then $28 million in the second. General education aid represents 73% of total education spending. This is the primary source of basic operating funds for schools and is largely determined by the number of pupils served, which decreased from the November forecast to this forecast. A forecast decline in school pupils is the primary driver of the change in general education. Most of general education revenue is in the basic formula, which is a uniform allowance per pupil. So there's the direct connection between the pupil forecast and the amount of basic general education revenue. The change in pupils also affects other components of general education revenue, such as local optional revenue, equity revenue, and operating capital revenue. Compensatory revenue is another component of general education. And it is based on the number and concentration of students eligible for free and reduced price meals from the prior school year. It is based on the number, the underreporting that we're seeing, that we saw in this area last year, does look to be continuing to be a problem for this school year. And so we're seeing an overall decrease in general education spending in this area again. Then the other notable change that we have in general education is a one-time final payment reduction of $35 million for FY21. Actual pupil data was much lower than expected in November due to more complete early reporting than we typically see. Since it's a significant savings, it's being carried in this forecast. Then in the 22-23 biennium, special education aid is declining by $69 million, or 1.9%. This is primarily due to lower projected expenditures in the prior year, since it's a prior year-based formula for most school districts. Since most of this lower expenditures is in the area of contracted transportation costs from last year, and that's attributable to the district's use of hybrid and distance learning plans due to COVID last year. Then in the next slide, this next slide shows the biennial growth change in general education funding expenditures. Overall, education spending is expected to increase by 3.8% in the first biennium, and then another 3.6% in the second biennium. The two largest programs driving this growth is general education and special education, and that accounts for about almost 98% of the E-12 growth. General education is expected to increase by 2.8% in the first biennium, and then an additional 1.7% in the second biennium. Special education, which accounts for about 17% of total education spending, is expected to grow 9.7% in the first biennium, and then another 12.5% in the second. The proportion of students with disabilities continues to grow, and the cost for providing special education services to each student is expected to continue to grow. The next area that I wanted to point out is interdistrict desegregation transportation. Even though this is a relatively small program in terms of state spending, it provides funding for prior year transportation costs for achievement and integration programs. It's down in the first biennium primarily due to the disruption in some of these programs last year due to COVID. Then the growth trends in the nutrition programs have also been changed by COVID. The 13.6% growth that you see in the first biennium is largely attributable to the federal subsidies that came in for FY21. And that greatly reduced the need for the state cost for these programs. The state reimbursements for these programs are expected to be back to pre-pandemic levels by the second biennium. So you see a continued growth between the first biennium and the second biennium for the nutrition programs. Then on the next slide, we have a little bit more information showing on our pupil projection, since that drives so much of the state spending in E-12 education. The numbers that you see are actually are showing now actuals through FY21. The FY21 numbers used for the November forecast were based on our projections of actuals based on the early preliminary student reporting. And that's the November or the February forecast. What you see is represented by the solid line compared to the dashed line. So what the data shows is some trend changes throughout the series that you see on the chart. Basically, when you look at the early years, you see a pretty large growth showing in the early years that are showing in the slide. And then from 18 to 20, what you see is a slower growth rate in the actual pupils that are reported for public education. After 20, you see a sharp decline in pupils into FY21. In response to COVID, the COVID pandemic, and the implementation of distance learning from last year, some families chose to delay enrollment in kindergarten or pursue non-public or homeschool options. And this decreased significantly public school enrollments last year. Overall, final pupil counts are down about 3,500 or 0.4% from what we were showing for the November forecast. And that basically is due, as I had said, to better than what we typically see for early reporting of those actual student numbers from districts. The lower projection for FY21, or the lower actual numbers, do factor into lower pupil projections in the out years. We know the impact of COVID on FY21 was very significant. What we don't know is what the impact is going to be for this current school year. This current school year is still very uncertain. What we've seen is looking at our fall enrollment data, while public school enrollments this past fall were down about 0.25% from the previous fall, we're still expecting some recovery this year as pupils move in and out of public schools throughout the school year. The funding for E-12 education is largely based on the average daily membership of students throughout the school year. And so the fall enrollments were, I think, considered, being a snapshot, maybe underrepresenting what we're expecting to see as memberships change throughout the school year. Mm-hmm. Also, I should note that given the uncertainty that we're seeing with programming and disruptions in programming in this year, we felt that a more conservative approach to the pupil forecast for FY22 was warranted. Then continuing on from there, you see a modest increase in growth for FY23, and then that's followed by a year-over-year decline in growth for FY24 and 25. This is an actual decrease rather than just decreasing growth for public school pupils. So what this is representing is really a trend change from what we have seen for a large number of years for public school pupils. And this is largely due to recent trends in lower birth rates that we're seeing, particularly a large decrease in 2020. So what we're starting to see now as we look toward the out years of our pupil forecast is that the declining birth rates that we've been seeing in recent years is starting to have an impact on the K-12 enrollments that we're seeing in out years. That concludes the presentation that we have, and I thank you for your time here.
Thank you, Ms. Yetter. Member questions. There was quite a bit of detail in both of those presentations. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious if immigration trends were also part of the decline in enrollment and whether that was taken into account, because I noticed that those trends started kind of midway through the previous administration, and I know that there was a big impact on immigration.
Ms. Yetter?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the question. We have noticed, we do look at within our student data, districts report the last location for students, and we have seen that immigration trends from students arriving from other countries is down from what we had seen. Mm-hmm. We are expecting, though, with the recent activity that we've seen with immigration from Afghanistan and other countries, that we're expecting an uptick again in some immigration. And so we did factor that into our forecast, both, I believe, somewhat in our November forecast and then again in our February forecast to add some additional pupils, having some anticipation that there may be some growth in immigrant students in Minnesota.
Representative Feist, any follow-up?
No, thank you. That was interesting.
Questions from other members? A lot to take in. Seeing none, Mr. Snowbrick, Ms. Yetter, thank you both for sharing your information and spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Members, we'll now move to House File 2949 from Representative Feist, a bill that relates to linking the general education formula mm-hmm. to inflation. It's our intention to lay this bill over for further consideration by 11:45. Representative Feist, would you like to make a motion to move House File 2949 before the committee to lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Thank you very much. Representative Feist, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Investing in the education of Minnesota's next generation of leaders, tradespeople, and engineers, educators, and thought leaders is the most important investment that we can make as a state. The return on this investment is incalculable, except probably by Tim Strom and Christina Parra. And yet, if we don't take affirmative action, we invest less in our state education budget year after year because we do not adjust the budget to take into account inflation. Notably, an estimate of inflation in state expenditures was removed from the state budget forecast in 2002 to balance the budget when the state was facing a significant shortfall. The general education formula allowance, the most important funding stream for public schools, would be $798 per pupil higher in 2023 if it had simply kept pace with inflation since 2003. As a result, school districts have been forced to rely on voter-approved operating referendums to make up the difference. The reliance on the referendums has created an unstable and inequitable funding system. The general education budget is uniquely impacted by inflation due to its reliance on a per-pupil formula rather than a specific allocation to cover specific anticipated costs. This bill will ensure that schools are able to plan ahead without the uncertainty that inflation creates in budgeting for future school years. It has strong support from the following organizations: the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota School Boards Association, Minnesota Rural Education Association, and Schools for Equity in Education. I will now turn things over to my testifiers for a more concrete illustration of how this issue, the issue that this bill seeks to address, including Superintendent Renee Cornet at St. Anthony New Brighton Schools and Tina Burkholder, the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Superintendent Cornet, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Renee Cornet, and I am the superintendent for St. Anthony New Brighton Schools. I just want to give a little caveat here. I am in a school building in my office, and you may hear it's concert week, so the band is practicing. So if you hear some drums, I promise it's not just me with the radio on in the background. So before that caveat, I'd like to also thank Representative Feist for sponsoring House File 2949. And I really appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this important bill on behalf of St. Anthony New Brighton Schools, along with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. You know, as a district committed to success for all of our students by establishing high expectations and high support, it is imperative that we have access to reliable state funding. As this committee knows, you all know this, the Minnesota Constitution clearly articulates that the stability of a Republican form of government, it depends on the intelligence of the people. So it's the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, which can only be accomplished by providing adequate, and I would also say reliable funding. House File 2949 provides districts like mine the power of a dependable revenue source. St. Anthony New Brighton Schools is the smallest geographic district in the entire state of Minnesota. It's also the smallest by enrollment in the metropolitan area. Being small has many advantages, but unfortunately, districts my size are super sensitive to small shifts in enrollment or changes in inflation because we run an extremely precise budget. For example, St. Anthony New Brighton Schools, we had to make some significant staff reductions last year in all areas of our organization. We had to cover an almost $900,000 budget deficit. Moving into the 22-23 school year, we will again have to make some significant reductions. I promise you this is not because of drastic enrollment declines. It's not because we've hired additional staff. Actually, the contrary. We've had to make those reductions because funding from the state has just not kept up with costs. Even with the increase in the general educational formula for this current biennium, our district will need to reduce our roughly $24 million budget by 3% next year. I want to articulate every collective bargaining agreement negotiated in our district has provided only minimal increases that also do not cover the cost of living increases our employees face. This deficit is not because of outrageous spending by the district. The deficit is because employees need to be provided with a livable wage, and our children, they need access to relevant curriculum, and our facilities must be safe. The problem lies in the current approach to determining that general education formula. The current approach is it's political, it's unpredictable, and it's inconsistent. One example I can share is that districts, by law, we need to approve our budget by June 30th. There are many times schools are approving their budgets without even knowing what the funding would be from the state. House File 2949 will allow districts the ability to predict, feel confident, and assume a steady funding source. So you might ask, why is this important? Number one, public school districts, we have a moral imperative to ensure that students leave our schools equipped with the skills, the knowledge, to not just be educated citizens, but ethical citizens. The legislature, you, per that constitution, also have a moral imperative to ensure that our districts are funded to allow for an educated citizenry. Second, by passing House File 2949, districts will be given the freedom to educate children without major interruptions. Without a reliable and predictable funding source, districts will need to reduce staff, reduce programs, and that comes with reducing opportunities for our students. Plus, seek many additional funding by going out for our local levies. All these actions take away what is most important. We know that the state provides their biggest budget item is schools. We need and we must educate our future citizens. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to support House File Bill 2949. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Cornet. Next, Tina Burkholder, Director of Business Services at the Monticello Public Schools. Ms. Burkholder, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Burkholder. I am the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools and a past president of MASBO, which is the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. As a school business official who is responsible for the budget, I give various school finance 101 presentations to our public and staff. I try to keep it as simple as possible and highlight two things: the revenue coming in and the expenses going out. First, I think it's important for people to understand the biggest chunk of revenue that school districts receive comes in the form of state aid, which is approximately 75 to 80% of the revenue budget. Within that state aid, the largest source of revenue, as Terry mentioned, is the general education formula, which is based on a school district's enrollment. Since 2008, the average increase on the general education formula allowance has been 1.5%. Next, I move on to expenses. The largest expense of a school district's budget is people. Nearly 80% of a school district budget goes towards salaries and benefits. Therefore, employee contracts play a significant role in developing a budget. Existing employment contracts include salary increases based on years of service and or education, also known as steps and lanes. These existing terms often equal or exceed the increase in state aid in a given year. For Monticello, the existing terms of a contract before any salary improvements are offered often equates to 1.5% to 2%. Budgeting for changes in employment contracts becomes challenging as the school district wants to continue to have good contracts for our employees that honor longevity, the increasing cost of healthcare, and the cost of living. To tie these two points together, if a newly bargained contract has 1.5% of built-in costs plus 2% in salary improvements, and if the state aid increase on average is 1.5%, we generate a budget gap, creating challenges for school districts each year. Expenses in the other 20%, such as utilities, transportation, or fuel costs, are also hard to contain without inflationary increases on the general education formula. I ask for your support for House File 2949 to tie the general education formula allowance to inflation to help school districts try to close that budget gap. Thank you for the time today, and I'd be happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Thank you, Ms. Burkholder. Members, questions for the testifiers or for the author? Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. End of the bill, author. Just a quick clarifying question. In your testimony in the opening comments, you mentioned that many schools have voter-approved levies, and then you said that creates an unequal funding. Can you explain that?
Representative Feist.
Yes, thank you, Representative Kreshaw, for the question. So not every community is able to or as supportive of those local levies. And so some schools receive that funding. I just know in my own district that some portions of my district have been able to pass these levies and others have not been able to because the communities might feel that they can't take that on. And so it is our responsibility as the state to ensure that all students across the state receive the same support. And that's what this bill seeks to do.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, so from a taxpayer point of view, the taxpayers who are directly responsible for the services in their area, and this is just a philosophical question, but why is it unequal if the taxpayers choose to not do something or to not fund something? There's lots of reasons why they may not. And aren't they the closest ones to determining the educational services for their area?
Representative Feist, care to take on a philosophical question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, happy to. What this bill seeks to do is ensure that our intention as the legislature is reflected in our education budget. Right now, we have an intention that is a set number, and if that is not adjusted for inflation, then essentially each year that funding goes less far. And so, you know, localities have the option to choose whether to supplement our budget, but the issue is that our budget is not doing what it is intended to do due to inflation. So it's really about just manifesting our intention when we set that budget.
Representative Kreshaw?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarifying to the bill author. I would just add, so I agree with you that whether or not the state decides to up their portion or not, but the state's formula is equal. We can get into compensatory and all that, but as the mechanism is put together, it is sent out equally on a per pupil basis and the formula. I would just caution us not to go down the path of suggesting because some voter referendums fail that is an unequal situation. We don't know the intentions of those communities and those voters, and we may offer supplements. We may look for ways to help them, but I think the state is at least fulfilling their obligation of adequate, and the courts have actually come back and said the state has fulfilled their adequate. The question is whether or not we want to increase from an adequate standard to a different standard. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Feist for bringing this bill. I think what we're talking about is the basic need for education across the state, and what we do as a state has been, you know, if you think of it when you're baking a cake, the cake is the most important part, right? Some of us love the frosting, but the frosting's always supposed to be that little extra on top. And to the levy question, that those levies, that voter approval levies, are supposed to have always been that frosting for those extras. Because we've short funded our schools by not having it linked to inflation, that frosting has become part of the cake. And I think that's what Representative Feist was trying to point out. But back to this bill, I think it is incredibly important, if I heard Representative Feist correctly, that if we would have kept up with inflation, it'd be $700 more per pupil. That is an enormous amount for a school district. And why that's so important is, having been a local elected, knowing that you have a stable source of funding in the future helps you plan, and it helps you do more innovative things, and it helps you plan for those things. And we're asking our districts to do so much more than we have in the past, to fill the opportunity gap, to meet kids where they're at, to do mental health supports, lots of things that we've heard in this committee alone. And they need money to do that. And we haven't kept up with inflation. And we need to do that in order to meet kids where they're at and have them be successful in life. And I think it's a pretty basic thing to think about, that we need to add inflation to this formula and a few of the others. And we can talk about evening things out with equalization, which we do, and we're going to be hearing bills to do that as well. But thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this forward. We need to make sure that cake is a stable foundation for our districts to make those plans. And then maybe we can also get away from the conversation about unfunded mandates, because they'll actually have the money to do what they need to do. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to thank Representative Feist and just note that educators in my district have filed intentions to strike and have held votes, and a lot of that is due to funding. They need these things for their students, and their students are needing them. We've heard from students about all the supports they need in schools, but our districts do not have that money. And I think that this is a small step we can take into making sure that districts can plan and that educators and students have the learning conditions that they need to succeed. So thank you, Representative Feist, for your leadership on this.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Any other questions from committee members or philosophical points? Seeing none, Representative Feist, brief closing.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill exemplifies the type of legislation that I hoped to bring when I got elected. It is wonky and technical and meaningful, and it addresses a really significant issue and flaw in how we calculate our education budget. This bill will ensure that schools have the predictable funding that they need to plan ahead, to innovate, and to make sure that we are training our future leaders and workforce in the best way that we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Thank you, Superintendent Cornet and Ms. Burkholder. Let me also assure the committee that when this bill was posted, we provided instructions to the public on how to sign up to testify, but received no requests. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion to lay over House File 2949 for possible inclusion or further consideration at a later date. Representative Wolgamon, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our final bill for today is House File 3727. It's our intention to lay this bill over by 11:55 a.m. Representative Wolgamott, would you like to make a motion to move House File 3727 to be before the committee and lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Outstanding. Thank you very much. Representative Wolgamott, please introduce your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to come before you to present House File 3727, which is just kind of a cleanup bill. Under current law, districts receive 87.66 of their special education aid in the fiscal year that they generate it, and the remaining 12.34% they receive in the following year. This bill changes that shift in payments for special education aid, so the districts receive 90% of the aid in the year that they generate it, and 10% the following year. That's the same manner they receive general education revenue and most other school aid. I just want to be clear that this will help with the school's cash flow, but it does not affect the revenue that they receive by the school district. It's just that they receive from the state. It just affects the timing in which they get it. This will get them money quicker, and we'll be able to marginally strengthen and simplify our state's overall budget. How we get funding to our schools has nothing to do with increase or decrease in permanent spending, just the timing in which schools get their special education aid.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. And I see that Ms. Burkholder has stayed to testify on this bill as well. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back to the committee. Please again introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony on House File 3727.
Well, thanks again, Chair. For the record, my name is Tina Burkholder, and I'm the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools and a past president of MASBA, which is the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. I don't have much to add in my testimony. School finance is complicated and not the easiest subject to present on. And when I give presentations, I often feel like I'm giving disclaimers or little asterisks for exceptions to the rules. So while House File 3727 is a small change in how special education payments are made to school in the current year. It's not a big effect on schools, but it would remove one of those asterisks or disclaimers that when we try to simplify and talk about school finance to the public or residents or staff in our buildings. This would also, I believe, give consistency to the Minnesota Department of Education in how they distribute revenue to schools and make their lives maybe a little easier as well. That's all I had. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Burkholder. When this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify. During the public portion of the bill hearing, we received no requests for public testimony. Member questions? Representative Wogelman, it appears that simple, boring, good government bookkeeping bills don't provoke philosophical conversations. Do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I urge your support for this bill to streamline the way that we get our school districts their special education aid. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wogelman. And with that, Representative Wogelman renews his motion to lay over House File 3727 for possible inclusion or for further consideration at a later date. Members, we'll have another full day tomorrow. I look forward to seeing you then. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.